Welcome. In this lecture, we turn to a subject that affected everyone in the Mediterranean at a profound level: sickness and its cure. In the first part, I'm going to talk about the physical circumstances affecting health in the Mediterranean, primarily in the imperial period. And in the second part, I'm going to talk about the medical profession and the quality of care that it provided. Probably the biggest health hazard was the killer epidemics, an annual occurrence, particularly in densely populated cities or in cities which were under siege. They were so frequent that they mostly go unrecorded in our sources. The most detailed description of a plague and its devastating effects is provided by the Athenian historian Thucydides. The plague in question, its identity is disputed, first ravished Athens in 430 BC. It broke out because Athens' population took refuge within the city walls when the Peloponnesians invaded Attica and laid waste the countryside. Outbreaks of plague were equally common in the Roman world. Livy describes a plague breaking out in Rome in 462 BC when people living in the countryside fled to the city in similar circumstances. And over time, outbreaks of plague increased in scale. It's estimated that the plague, which broke out in the reign of the Emperor Marcus Aurelius in AD 165, probably reduced the empire's population by as much as 10%. The plague in question may have been smallpox, which a Roman army contracted in Persia, modern-day Iran. There are reports of the plague spreading to Greece, Italy, Turkey, Syria, France, and Germany. And it says much of the degree to which the Mediterranean basin constituted one culture by the 2nd century AD that it was able to spread so extensively. A similar phenomenon occurred in the reign of Justinian in 541 when bubonic plague broke out in Egypt and then spread throughout the whole empire from Britain in the west to Syria in the east. Plague is, in fact, a metaphor for our course, albeit a very dark metaphor. It demonstrates the truly integrated nature of life in the Mediterranean in later antiquity. Although ancient diseases are notoriously difficult to identify, even when paleopathologists have skeletal evidence to work with, major killers are thought to have included gastroenteritis, dysentery, diarrhea, beriberi, rickets, scurvy, malaria, typhoid, pneumonia, and tuberculosis. Some sexually transmitted diseases were also known, though not syphilis or gonorrhea. Cancer was known, with breast cancer, according to Galen, a physician of the 2nd century AD, being particularly common. It's also worth bearing in mind that most people had to deal with physical pain on a level and with a frequency and an intensity that is virtually inconceivable in the West today. I'm not just talking about headaches and stomach aches, awful and incapacitating though those may be. I'm talking about having a leg or an arm amputated without anaesthetic. Part of the reason for the spread of disease was the fact that sanitary standards were low, although both the Greeks and the Romans did comprehend the necessity of clean drinking water, hence the importance that they attached to public fountains and aqueducts. Our word hygiene comes, in fact, from Hygieia, the daughter of the healing god Asclepius. However, Hygieia personified health, not hygiene as such. The Roman equivalent was the goddess Salus, whose cult was established around 300 BC and who became identified with Hygieia in the 2nd century BC. In particular, the preparation of food would have left a great deal to be desired. Just imagine a big fat fly landing on a piece of melon or a rat foraging through a supply of cheese before it got served to the master of the house. An equally important problem was the disposal of human waste and garbage. Though Rome, for instance, was served by the Cloaca Maxima, the great drain, which runs beneath the forum and which in places is 4.5 meters wide and over 3 meters high, it not infrequently flooded. In addition, rotting piles of maggoty rubbish would have gathered in the streets. It's been estimated that Rome produced 1 million cubic meters of waste annually. If you were lucky enough to have a toilet, it was probably located next to the kitchen, which was where the opening in the sewer would be, assuming there was a sewer in the house. It was the Romans who invented public toilets. They did not, however, provide cubicles, and women and men commonly sat alongside one another. And instead of toilet paper, sponge sticks were used. Probably you rented a sponge stick as you entered the public toilet and returned it to the attendant to be cleaned afterwards. Infant mortality, the deaths of children in their first year of life, was probably as high as 25%. Average life expectancy at birth throughout the Roman Empire in the 1st and 2nd centuries AD is put at around 25 years of age, or even a bit lower. This figure is based not primarily on ancient evidence, but rather on comparative data, particularly from India and China in the early 20th century, where similar socio-economic conditions prevailed. Ancient evidence about life expectancy tends to be unreliable. For instance, inscriptions on Roman gravestones sometimes record the exact age of the deceased, but we need to bear in mind, A, that those who erected gravestones were at least in the middle income bracket and therefore not representative of the population as a whole, and B, that there was a propensity to exaggerate age by age rounding. So age at death is often recorded in pentads and decades, 35, 40, 45, etc., and the tendency was to round up. Given the brevity of human life, an individual's trajectory had a very different feel to it from what it does today. There would have been relatively few elderly people, at least in the sense in which we understand the word elderly, and a very large number of teenagers. Incidentally, Cicero wrote a dialogue on old age shortly before he was murdered. It almost amounts to a celebration of old age, and it draws heavily from Greek philosophy, which is interesting in view of the fact that the principal speaker is Cato the Elder. Old age, says Cato, so far from being slow and feeble, is lively and always full of beans. Some people never stop learning, however old they are. For the past 100 years, average life expectancy in the West has been increasing at the rate of 2.2 years per decade. In antiquity, however, the percentage of people who lived to be 80 was so minute that the 2nd century AD Greek satirist Lucian wrote a book called Long Livers, Makrobioi. Geriatrics might be an appropriate equivalent, in which he listed famous people who had achieved 80 or more. The evidence is slight, but it seems that males may have had a slightly higher life expectancy than females. As Bruce Freer notes, the Roman Empire probably enjoyed modest demographic growth, as have most societies throughout human history. I'll now turn to the medical profession. The first point to note is that only the wealthy could afford the services of a physician. Herodotus, writing in the 5th century BC, tells us of the practice of hiring public physicians who then became both famous and rich, but since there were so few of them, they could only have provided medical care for a minute fraction of the citizen body. And this situation remained much the same throughout antiquity. In AD 160, the emperor Antoninus Pius passed a statute limiting the number of public physicians to 10 in the case of capital cities of provinces, and 7 in the case of major cities, and 5 in the case of small towns. So some scholars see the title public physician as a kind of honorific rather than as meaning providing a service for the public. It follows that most sick people either got better by themselves or died. There were no hospitals, no mental institutions, and no old people's homes. Most people worked when they were sick or otherwise incapacitated, And this included pregnant and postpartum women, which is one of the reasons why the longevity of females is likely to have been slightly lower than that of males. Women probably received less medical attention than men, and girls less attention than boys. That's because females were more expendable than males in economic terms. There would have been very few long-term invalids, except for those who were very wealthy, those, that is, who could afford to be attended to round the clock by their slaves. Pliny the Younger tells us of a paralyzed Roman called Domitius Tullius, who was unable to feed himself and who, I quote, used to complain that every day he licked the fingers of his slaves. There was very little medical care available outside the cities. Overall, therefore, it's fair to say that physicians had minimal impact in improving the health of the general population. They certainly would have been useless in stemming the onslaught of an epidemic. And, it has to be added, much of what they practiced would not be considered acceptable today. There were some very barbaric procedures that were carried out in the name of medical science, as we know from medical writings. An example is trepanation, the procedure by which a hole is drilled or scraped into the skull. Trepanation is first described in a medical text of the 5th century BC, ascribed to Hippocrates, and later in a work by Galen of the 2nd century AD. This suggests that it remained popular throughout antiquity. I think it's a fair assumption that if you became seriously sick or disabled and didn't have a family member to take care of you, then your chances of survival were not particularly bright. And this, incidentally, is one of the reasons why adoption was so popular throughout the Mediterranean world. The adopted child or adolescent or young man would enter into a legal agreement with his adoptive father. We're talking pretty well exclusively of adoption by males. And in return for becoming his heir and inheriting his fortune, he would undertake to look after his father in old age, as well as to give him rites of burial. The first evidence of a serious interest in medical healing in the Greco-Roman world dates to the end of the 6th century BC, when the cult of the healing god Asclepius began to gain importance in the Greek-speaking world. Prior to this date, healing had been in the hands of more lowly figures, known as hero physicians. Asclepius's attribute was a snake wrapped around a staff. The snake symbolized his healing power, since snakes undergo regeneration by sloughing off their old skin, and the wand represented the authority of his office as a healer. The cult of Asclepius first established itself at Epidaurus in the northeast Peloponnese. Other important sanctuaries were established at Athens in 420, at Pergamum, probably by the 4th century BC, and at Rome in 291. Patients seeking a cure would sleep in a dormitory. If the god looked favorably upon them, he would visit them in a dream and suggest a cure. Think what we like about miraculous healing. The ancient world has left us plenty of evidence of its efficacy, both in the form of inscriptions put up by grateful patients recording their cures, and in the form of anatomical offerings in the shape of the body part that was cured: leg, arm, hand, foot, knee, breast, head, womb, etc. Rational medicine in Greece originates around the time of the legendary Hippocrates of Kos, whose supposed dates are 469 to 399 BC. It was founded on the premise that medical science should always be extending its capacity to heal. As the author of a 5th century BC treatise entitled On Ancient Medicine, that is contemporary with the legendary Hippocrates, wrote, "There have been many wonderful medical discoveries over the course of time, and the rest will be discovered if an accomplished man familiar with the findings of the past uses them as a basis for his discoveries. Now, that's a fairly ambitious agenda, you'll note. Usually, we would expect such an important development as the introduction of rational medicine to be part of a process rather than ascribable to one individual. But Hippocrates is the person whom the Greeks exclusively credited with this innovation, and we don't have any evidence with which to challenge it. What's yet more infuriating, and historians do regularly get infuriated by their sources, or rather by the lack of them, is that though Hippocrates is certainly the best known physician of antiquity by name, we know virtually nothing about his life. Some 60 medical treatises are ascribed to him. However, the majority, if not all, are the work of his pupils and other physicians who were connected with what scholars call the Hippocratic school. A school is, in fact, a misnomer. We certainly shouldn't be thinking in terms of an institution, but rather a group of physicians with a similar medical outlook. The treatises were mostly written between 420 and 370 BC, though a few of them are considerably later. And just to hit the nail squarely on the head, we don't know of a single treatise that can be definitely attributed to Hippocrates. The great German scholar Willemowitz memorably described Hippocrates as a name without a work. Leaving aside all the mystery surrounding his personality, his accomplishments, and his career, the works ascribed to Hippocrates are quite remarkable for their absence of any appeal to magic or religious dogma, such as disease as a punishment inflicted by the gods, an idea which still occasionally rears its ugly head today. Human observation, human expertise, human understanding, that's what they're about. And though some of the procedures that the writers of the treatises recommend may strike us as gruesome, the attention that they pay to diagnosis and prognosis is impressive by the standards of any age. In short, they represent a colossal breakthrough for science, and it seems that this breakthrough met with very little resistance, even from the priesthood of the healing god Asclepius. On the contrary, there's clear evidence that what we would call faith healing and medicine were carried on side by side at the sanctuaries of Asclepius as complementary rather than contradictory approaches to disease and its cure. Galen, who was the most influential physician of late antiquity, claimed that he took up medicine because the god appeared to him in a dream and urged upon him a medical career when his father was sick. In fact, the sanctuaries of Asclepius were the nearest thing to a hospital that existed in the Mediterranean world. We know this because surgical instruments of Roman date have been found in a number of these sanctuaries, including Epidaurus. The Greeks may well have been the first to perform dissections on human cadavers. The two physicians who are credited with this development were Erasistratus and Herophilus, both practicing in Alexandria in the first half of the 3rd century BC. It's also reported that they performed vivisection on criminals. Partly out of squeamishness, however, dissection on human beings was rarely performed in the ancient world, though there is no evidence of an outright ban. Even Galen performed dissections, not on human corpses, but on apes and monkeys. It's interesting to note that the Romans never produced a body of medical treatises remotely comparable to that ascribed to Hippocrates. In fact, it may actually be the case that no Roman ever wrote an original medical treatise, though they did assemble compendia. For instance, Celsus, who lived in the first half of the 1st century AD, wrote an encyclopedia of medical lore. However, we don't even know whether Celsus practiced medicine himself or whether he was simply an armchair synthesizer of medicine. Like the Greeks, however, the Romans did believe in the complementarity of the medical and the religious. From the time of Augustus onwards, they performed rites in honor of the goddess Salus Publica, the personification of health and welfare of the community, which embodied too the health and welfare of the emperor. One of the most important physicians of the first century AD was Dioscorides, who wrote extensively on the medicinal properties of minerals, animal byproducts, and herbs. A leading figure in the early second century AD was Serranus of Ephesus, who wrote four books on gynecology. Among the subjects he covered are conception, the role of the midwife, childbirth, and the care of the newborn. Serranus also provides a useful summary of previous discussions about women's bodies, which brings up an extremely important issue. One of the most hotly debated topics in medical circles in antiquity was how closely related men and women are physiologically. The answer had important implications for medical practice because if women and men are different physiologically, then it follows that they may be subject to different diseases and must be treated differently as well. This debate dates from the beginnings of Greek rational medicine. There's a Hippocratic text entitled On Women that attacks physicians who treat women the same way as men. And it continued at least as late as the 2nd century AD. Serranus, to his credit, believed that women's diseases were no different from men's. The outstanding physician of the next generation was Galen, whose dates are AD 129 to 204. He came from Pergamum, which was home to a very important cult of Asclepius. He began his career tending injured gladiators, an excellent hands-on way, literally, to learn about anatomy. He later studied in Alexandria and ultimately became court physician to three emperors, Marcus Aurelius, Commodus, and Severus. His meteoric rise to prominence demonstrates just how valued were the services of a top-notch Greek physician among the Roman elite. Galen sought to encompass the entirety of medical knowledge. Some 350 treatises are attributed to him. He held that health and sickness depended in part upon the relative proportions in which the four humours, blood, phlegm, yellow bile, and black bile, are found in the body. It's a belief that first turns up in a Hippocratic treatise called On the Nature of Man. As in the modern medical profession, so in antiquity, there were specialists. Some specialised in setting bones, others in cutting the umbilical cord, for instance. Galen himself had no time for specialists. He maintained that it's necessary to have a sense of the wholeness of the body to be a really effective doctor. But, and it's a very important but, as we've seen, he believed in the healing god Asclepius. So like physicians centuries earlier, he combined rational medicine with faith-based healing. And his teachings remained influential in the Middle Ages and even beyond. The principal centres of medical learning, Alexandria, Ephesus, Pergamum, were all Greek. They remained prominent into late antiquity, with Alexandria taking pride of place. However, there seem to have been no medical schools as such. Contacts between physicians at these centres seem to have happened more or less informally. By the 4th century AD, however, we do find evidence for the existence of medical schools. So far, I've talked only about the superstars of the medical profession. What about ordinary physicians? They too, throughout antiquity, were mainly Greek. In the absence of teaching institutions, most of them probably attached themselves as apprentices to established physicians. As there were no medical qualifications, anyone could declare himself to be a healer. Whether he succeeded depended on whether he was able to chalk up a sufficient number of successful cures to his credit. The more spectacular the cures, the more spectacular his reputation became. As luck would have it, we actually know a bit about the first Greek physician to practice in Rome. His name was Archagathus, a very Greek-sounding name, meaning good leader or leader of the good, and he arrived in Rome in 219 BC from the Peloponnese. At first, he was very successful. Pliny the Elder tells us that as soon as he arrived in Rome, he was granted Roman citizenship and given premises at public expense from which to practice. He was, Pliny says, a remarkable healer of wounds. In time, however, because of his cruelty in cutting and cauterizing, he was nicknamed Carnifex, which means murderer, butcher, executioner, thereby bringing physicians and their art into disrepute. Pliny then goes on to quote Cato the Elder, the self-proclaimed Hellenophobe, who had this to say about Greek physicians in general. They have conspired among themselves to murder all foreigners with their medicine, a profession which they follow to make money, so as to win our confidence and do away with us all the more easily. A nice example of Roman conspiracy theory. Load of old rubbish. But Cato's comment reminds us of something important, that the antagonism and suspicion that existed between some Romans and Greeks would certainly have been exacerbated whenever a patient who was under the care of a Greek physician failed to pull through. You can just hear the mutterings. My old mum was doing fine until we called in that blasted Greek physician. I asked him what he put in that evil-smelling concoction he gave her, but he wouldn't tell me. She'd be alive today if we'd kept her on that good old-fashioned Roman cabbage diet. Mutter, mutter, mutter. A cabbage, by the way, was regarded by the Romans as a kind of panacea. Well, Cato wasn't the only Roman to be suspicious of doctors. Martial, who composed pithy epigrams that caught the popular mood in the first century AD, wrote, "Until recently, Diaulus, that's a Greek name, was a doctor. Now he's an undertaker. What he now does as an undertaker, he once did as a doctor." Greek physicians would not have earned the reputations they did, however, had they not enjoyed the confidence of the Roman people at large. One early physician who did enjoy their confidence was Asclepiades of Bithynia, who set up practice in Rome in 100 BC. Note the name Asclepiades. It means son of Asclepius. He obviously inscribed that name on his shingle, so to speak, because of the close ties that the healing god enjoyed with the medical profession. Asclepiades was successful because he brought about a fusion between Greek and Roman medical lore. In particular, he eschewed the cut-and-thrust school of medicine that was favoured by Archagathus and his like. He seems to have recommended warm baths, moderate exercise, and a healthy diet, all very sensible and very Roman. In fact, Asclepiades may have been instrumental in advancing the reputation of Greek medicine in Roman society precisely for this reason. So why were so many physicians Greek? One reason was because there was no tradition of Roman professional medicine. Before the Greeks came along, medicine was chiefly practiced in the Roman family, with recourse to homespun remedies about which we know very little. And another reason was that professional medicine was what we would call today a service industry, and Romans, as we've seen, didn't do service. And many physicians were ex-slaves. Only a minority were Roman citizens. One of the largest grants of citizenship to foreign physicians was made by Julius Caesar in 46 BC. Around the same time, the city of Ephesus granted its physicians immunity from taxation. Both these events may be taken as evidence of the importance that was now being attached to the profession in the Mediterranean. Despite their relatively low social status, however, some physicians earned huge fortunes. It was, in fact, the ancient world that produced the figure of the celebrity physician courted by the rich and powerful. And this was true throughout antiquity. A 6th century BC physician called Demosides worked successively on the island of Aegina, in Athens, and then on Samos, increasing his salary each time he moved. And going to the 2nd century AD, we're told that Galen was paid 400 gold pieces for a single operation. The dominance of Greek medicine throughout the Mediterranean tells us much about the relations between the Greeks and Romans. On the Roman side, there was an inherent resistance in certain quarters to Greek-style medicine and Greek physicians, coupled with a pride in self-reliance, distrust of novelty, suspicion of the motives of foreigners, and a necessary dependency on their expertise. And on the Greek side, there was that capacity for innovation, discovery, and refinement of technique, coupled with an ability to make good under Roman domination. So the history of the progress of Greek medicine tells us a great deal about the Romans' grudging acceptance of the fact that there were some things better left to the Greeks. To conclude, acknowledgement of the debt of Western medicine to the Greeks is indicated both by the continuing importance that is attached to the Hippocratic Oath and to the fact that the symbol of the medical profession is a caduceus, the wand of Hermes, around which a snake coils. The corpus of medical writings that has survived from classical antiquity is the most extensive in any literary genre from classical antiquity, even though a great deal has been lost, particularly the medical writings of the Hellenistic period. Galen's output alone comprises nearly 3 million words. And even after Galen, the flow of writing continued. One of the latest medical writers was Alexander of Tralles, who lived in the 6th century AD and who wrote a path-breaking treatise on parasitology entitled Letter on Intestinal Worms. In the next 3 lectures, we're going to focus upon other less copious literary genres where the influence of the Greeks was again paramount, but where the accomplishment of the Romans sometimes put them on a level with their illustrious predecessors and occasionally even above them.